Okay, we're going to call the Climate Protection Committee to order. So roll call.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of May 18th, 2017, Director Abe-Koga, Director Joya, Director Haggerty, Director Hudson,
here.
Director Rice,
here.
Director Ross, Director Wagon Connect, Committee Vice Chair Sinks,
here.
Committee Chair Barrett,
here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Okay. So, Pledge of Allegiance. Okay. Are there any public comments on non-agendized item?
I have no cards.
Okay. Approval of the minutes for March 22nd.
Move approval. That was move approval.
Okay. Do we need a vote on that? Okay. So the minutes are approved as submitted. So statewide scoping plan update.
Yes, Chair Barrett and members of the Climate Protection Committee, good morning. This morning we have Edie Chang, who's a Deputy Executive Officer at the California Air Resources Board, to give us an overview of the update to the statewide scoping plan. So, Ms. Chang.
Good morning. My name is Edie Chang. I'm a Deputy Executive Officer with the California Air Resources Board, and I'm really pleased to be here today to talk about our climate change scoping plan. It's a plan that we've been working on for almost 2 years now. We've been having a lot of public meetings, a lot of discussions with stakeholders, a lot of discussions within California state agencies, because this is an effort that is not just at the Air Resources Board, but it's an effort that spans state government. I think that we all know that the world shifted a little bit last fall with the election, and California has been a leader in climate change for a long time, but with the shift in policy at the federal government level, there's been even more attention to what's happening in California. I had the privilege of being at the UN climate conference, and it was right after the election, and there were a lot of folks that were asking us, they were really, really curious, what are you going to do? What is California going to do? Does this change what you're going to do? And even then, even a day or two after the election, we knew that what happens federally is not going to change what we do in California. We have our own motivations. We have our own state laws here in California. But I think what has changed is that the rest of the country and the rest of the world is looking at us even more. And I think that when we look at California, the Bay Area District is one of the districts that has done the most on climate change. It really is a leader when we look at action in the local and regional level. And this district, the region, the communities in this region have really been leaders on climate change. And I think that kind of leadership is really important as we continue moving forward. I know that you're going to be talking later today about implementation of the district's clean air plan, and I think this is really one example of an area where the district is really out leading, pulling together a plan that addresses toxics, criteria pollutants, and greenhouse gases all together. It's something that we've been striving to do at the Air Resources Board, but quite honestly, it's been really, really challenging. And so, it seems like, well, these are all the same sources, it should be kind of easy, but it's really challenging when you start looking into the details of what controls you're doing and what those impacts are. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn as we work together. So what I wanted to do today is just talk a little bit about the plan that we have proposed, talk a little bit about our timeline, and then I'm happy to take any questions. So this first slide just gives you an idea of the greenhouse gas targets, and it shows you sort of relative to a 1990 baseline, but that's the baseline that we've been using since AB 32 was passed in 1996. Our 2020 target is to reduce emissions back to the 1990 baseline. And then based on legislation that was passed in the last legislative session, SB 32 and AB 197, we're looking at a 30% reduction by 2030. And so you can see, or a 40% reduction. So you can see that that's a pretty steep decline. So we're looking at having to double the rate of emission reductions in the post-2020 timeframe. And then when you look further out into 2050, and that's an 80% reduction, that is in line with what climate scientists think is necessary if we're going to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. So these are really, really aggressive goals that we're looking at going forward. This graph gives you an idea of the progress that we have to date reducing greenhouse gases. So you can see there was a big dip in 2007, 2008, 2009 timeframe. That big dip is actually the recession. So that is a cessation of economic activity. But what we've seen, the really promising thing, is that as the economy has come back, we haven't seen emissions return to those same levels. What we're seeing in California is that emissions are going down while the economy is continuing to grow. Our per capita emissions are decreasing, and our emissions per dollar of gross state product are decreasing. And so that decoupling of carbon emissions and growth is what we want to see. This pie chart gives you an idea of what the emission sources are statewide by sector. And you can see that transportation sources are the largest sources of greenhouse gases. I think that it's the same way in the Bay Area as well. The industrial sector and electric power are the second and third largest sources. Commercial and residential is really like the natural gas that's used to heat your home or to cook your food if you have a natural gas stove. Agriculture includes emissions from dairies, like methane from dairies. It includes fertilizer usage and those kinds of emissions. High global warming potential gases are things like refrigerants. So this is 4% looks like a really small number, but it's actually the most rapidly growing sector as we look out into the future. Part of that is because the Montreal Protocol, we're switching into gases that have more global warming impacts. And so there's a lot of work that we're doing at the state level, trying to figure out what we can do at the federal level and also at the international level to try to address these refrigerants. And then recycling and waste is emissions from landfills and other sort of waste operations. So as we embarked on the scoping plan, this is the third scoping plan that we've done. We did the first one in 2008, 2 years after the first legislation passed. We did an update in 2014. And then with the advent of these new 2030 targets, we were asked to move forward and develop a new scoping plan on a faster than expected schedule. So as we thought about what do we want to accomplish in this scoping plan update, the first thing and probably the most important one to us, being this is what the statute says, is achieve the 2030 target. So, the statute says you want to reduce emissions. And so that is the goal, is we want to get there. Providing direct greenhouse gas emission reductions. So I mentioned AB 197. So this is legislation that was passed as companion legislation with the setting of the 2030 target. And that companion legislation asks us to prioritize direct greenhouse gas reductions from large industrial sources, from mobile sources, and from other sources. And so providing those direct greenhouse gas reductions is an important component of our plan in order to meet those statutory requirements. We're the Air Resources Board. We want to provide air quality co-benefits everywhere that we can in this process. You can imagine, as part of this discussion, our other state agency partners are also looking for places that we can advance the co-benefits that they care about also. So we've been working closely with Department of Food and Agriculture, the Resources Agency, the Energy Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, and there's a host of co-benefits that we can talk about in the scoping plan. The fourth bullet about minimizing emissions leakage is actually language that comes from the original text of AB 32. So AB 32 tells the Air Resources Board when we implement the scoping plan to try to minimize emissions leakage. And really, you should think about emissions leakage as both emissions leakage and economic leakage. So leakage, just real simply, is if emissions go down in California, but they go up someplace else. And so the atmosphere doesn't see a net benefit. That's really the concern. And, you know, as folks that are trying to put these regulations and this plan into place, there's also a concern about losing not just having no emissions benefit, but also losing the economic activity that's associated with that in California. We recognize that we are one of the few states that are acting in such a broad-based way. And because of that, we want to make sure that our industries and our consumers are protected. And so in thinking about how we implement this program, we have spent time thinking about how do we minimize emissions leakage, both because we want to have the right environmental outcome and also because we want to minimize economic impacts. Supporting climate investment in disadvantaged communities. One of the elements of our program is we have a cap and trade program. And as part of that program, we auction allowances or these permits to emit greenhouse gases. The allowances that are owned by the state, the revenue that's generated from them goes into an account, and that account is spent on programs that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So under statute, 10% of those programs have 10% of those funds have to be spent in disadvantaged communities. 25% of them have to be spent to benefit disadvantaged communities. In actuality, we've been overshooting those targets, and there is new legislation that also expands the funding requirements to also include low-income communities. So going forward, 35% of the funds need to be spent in disadvantaged and low-income communities. And so there's a whole host of programs that have been funded. We've got, I think the legislature has appropriated something like $3 billion in funds that originally came from the auction. And they're going to programs, everything from better, more transit-oriented development, to digester projects in the San Joaquin Valley, to electric vehicle rebates, to hybrid trucks. We're also interested in protecting public health, and that sort of seems like a no-brainer, but it is something that we are taking a really hard look at to make sure that as we implement our programs, we look at them in a way that we're taking the option that gets the best public health outcome. And the example that I like to use is active transportation. So, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is how can we reduce vehicle miles traveled? And there are lots of ways to do that. But to the extent that we can do it in ways that also encourage active transportation, that make it safer for people to bike and to walk, that also has a huge public health benefit that isn't just about, you know, reducing greenhouse gases or reducing air pollution in the air. It's about making people more active and making them healthier. So we've been working closely with the Department of Public Health, and we're looking for ways that we can expand our thinking about how to incorporate public health considerations into the implementation of these programs. Facilitating subnational and national collaboration. California is less than 2% of the greenhouse gases globally. So, you know, I tell people you could turn California off completely and it wouldn't really make a huge difference when you look at sort of global climate change. But how we can make a difference is that we can pioneer and implement policies that work. We can show how you can take these steps and build your economy and continue to move forward and to be envisioning the economy that we want to have in the future, not the economy that we have had. To have programs that other jurisdictions can export and can use. And so working with other states and provinces has been really important to us as we've gone forward. You probably know our cap and trade program is currently linked with the province of Quebec. We have proposed to link it with the province of Ontario. Ontario started their program in January, and they've had one auction. And we're proposing to link to them January of 2018. And there's also some conversations going on with, you know, other states have gotten a little bit interested, and there are some other countries that are also looking, you know, sort of are in the beginning stages of looking at programs. So, but I think that the, you know, I talked about leadership at the beginning. I think this is an area where it's really important for us as California and us as California sort of in total and whole to lead. Supporting cost-effective and flexible compliance. I think that to me, this is really about how can we achieve our goals in the cheapest possible way? So how can we make sure that we want to hit these environmental goals, but we want to do it in a way that doesn't cost more than it needs to? Because those costs are ultimately going to affect the economy in California and consumers in California. And then lastly, you know, this is a kind of a funny bullet now, but to support federal action. And I think that, you know, this is really morphed a little bit in the last 6 months from supporting efforts like the Federal Clean Power Plan and other federal action, but to also be modeling the kinds of things that could be happening at the federal level and to show that the things that are happening in California really can work. So it's a lot to balance, but I think that any time that we do plans, whether they're air quality plans or climate plans, these are the things I think that we're all thinking about. So this graph shows you the proposed scoping plan measures, and it shows you over time the contribution from each one of these different measures. The next slide I have is going to actually have a list of the measures, but we thought it would be useful just to give you an idea of the relative magnitude over time. And what you see is that the short-lived climate pollutant plan, so this is a plan that focuses on methane and refrigerants and black carbon, is actually one of the largest contributors to reaching our 2030 goals. Our mobile source strategy, which is a key part of how we're going to attain ozone and particulate standards in the San Joaquin Valley and South Coast, is another really key portion of how we're going to move forward. We're also proposing energy efficiency measures. There's a state law requiring a 50% renewable portfolio standard. We've proposed a measure that's focused on getting a 20% reduction in greenhouse gases from the refining sector. We've proposed to expand the low carbon fuel standard, additional electricity measures, reducing, looking at demand response. And then the crosshatch area down on the bottom is the cap and trade program. And so you can see the other measures that we're proposing to implement actually keep us pretty well on the trajectory until about 2023, maybe. And at that point, the cap and trade program starts becoming more important in hitting our 2030 targets. So this is the list of measures that are in the proposed scoping plan. And the items that are asterisked are things that already exist or they exist under state law. So they are things that we are already told that we must do, or they're regulations that we are already implementing. So SB 350 is a piece of legislation that called for 50% renewable portfolio standard and ramping up of the introduction of energy efficiency. I've talked a little bit about the short-lived climate pollutant plan, SB 375 to support sustainable community development, and I think you are all aware we're in the process of setting new SB 375 targets this year with our partners at the MPOs. I talked a little bit about our mobile source strategy and our low carbon fuel standard. We are also looking at freight and what we can do to reduce emissions from freight. The freight sector is one of the largest sources of toxic emissions in California, and the communities that live by freight facilities, whether they're ports or rail yards or warehousing facilities, are exposed to very, very high levels of diesel particulate. We want to move forward with a freight strategy that can help us reduce toxics, help us get NOx reductions in places like the South Coast, where it's going to be really important for attainment, and also move us into lower greenhouse gas emissions from that sector. So that's a very, very long-term plan. We've been working for a couple years with Caltrans and Energy Commission and the industry on the Sustainable Freight Action Plan. I talked a little bit about the refinery measure, and there's a little bit more detail on this slide. One of the things, as I mentioned, 197 did is 197 asked us to reduce direct emission reductions from industrial facilities and mobile sources. And we looked at, when we looked at the array of measures that we had in the past and that we had proposed for the scoping plan before 197 was passed, one area that we didn't have sort of a focused sector-specific regulation was the industrial sector. And so what we're proposing to do is target refineries. Refineries are the largest component of the industrial sector, and there's, I'd say, maybe two handfuls of them statewide, maybe three. So there aren't a lot of refineries, and they have a lot of emissions when you look at the industrial sector. So we're proposing to target that, and we're looking, what we're looking at is a 20% reduction from of greenhouse gas emissions. This is on a per barrel kind of basis. So what that means is what we would be looking is for the refining sector to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions it takes to make one barrel of a refined product of gasoline or diesel or jet fuel or whatever. And then the last item that is on the list is this is the cap and trade program. So we're proposing to extend the cap and trade program post 2020 so that it goes from 2020 to 2030. Okay, alternatives. So as we were going through this process, one of the things that we looked at is what are the other ways that we could meet the 2030 targets? And so I want to talk a little bit about some of the alternatives that we considered. We considered four alternatives. We actually started out with three alternatives, and in going through the public process, we heard feedback from stakeholders, and we added a couple alternatives that were discussed by the stakeholders. So the first alternative is, instead of doing cap and trade, so we have all of the asterisk measures from the previous slide. So everything that's asterisk, we pretty much already have to do. State law says we have to do it, or it's already underway. So the ones that are really sort of, we have some opportunity to play with are the bottom two. And so in this alternative with no cap and trade, we don't have a cap and trade program. And what we do is we do more focused regulations. And so in that scenario, instead of getting a 20% reduction from refineries, we propose a 30% reduction from refineries. And we also propose to have a 20% reduction from all other industrial facilities. We end up having to also, in order to meet the target in 2030, we have to increase the renewable portfolio standard. We have to increase the stringency of the low carbon fuel standard. So there's other things, I would say, it's sort of like we have to turn up the volume on every one of the measures a little bit. So it becomes, it's a lot of regulations and a lot of sort of increasing to get there. The second scenario that we looked at is a carbon tax. So this is another way to price carbon. Instead of having the cap and trade program, we would replace that component with a carbon tax. So the biggest difference between a carbon tax and a cap and trade program is in a cap and trade program, you have environmental certainty. You set your emissions cap, and that's what you're aiming for. And you can set up the program so there, you know, you only have so many allowances, you're going to get to that cap. In a carbon tax, you have more price certainty. And so you know what the cost is going to be, but it's harder to know whether you're going to hit your environmental target. So this proposal, and this was partly based on feedback from the public, is that we would have the existing commitments, and then we would have a tax that's imposed at the social cost of carbon. The social cost of carbon accounts for the damage that one ton of carbon released into the air does. It doesn't account for all of the damage. There are things that are not included. And this is a federal number that we're using. So we're using a number of $50 per metric ton in 2030. And I think the slide says it can be hard to set that correct tax to know that you're going to hit the 2030 target. The third alternative was an alternative that was proposed to us by industry stakeholders, and they suggested, why don't we do more cap and trade? And so in this proposal, that crosshatch area would expand. And in this proposal, there would be no specific refinery sector measure. And what they would propose is that we would freeze the low carbon fuel standard at its current stringency. So what we're proposing to do is make the low carbon fuel standard more stringent post-2020. They would propose to freeze that and just continue it going forward. This has a lower direct cost than the proposed plan. It relies more on cap and trade, but we feel that it's less responsive to the statutory direction that we've received. And then the last option that we looked at was a cap and tax. And so this is a proposal that I'm going to go in the order here. All the greenhouse gas emissions are taxed. So there's an amount that you pay for every ton of greenhouse gas emissions that you emit. And then individual fuel suppliers, utilities, and industrial facilities would each have a facility-specific reduction that they're required to get. So they would have to get, every facility would have to have a 40% reduction over the 10-year period between 2021 and 2030. And so that means every facility, everyone who imports fuel, every utility would have to reduce by 4% a year. So there's no trading in this option, and it's facility specific. So this has higher proposed cost, a higher direct cost than the proposed plan. But, you know, and I think that, you know, one of the challenges I think with this is trying to make sure that there are ways that facilities can make those reductions. And then the other concern in this proposal is leakage. Because there's not as much flexibility in it, and if facilities are going to have to reduce throughput in order to meet those caps, you know, thinking about what happens in those situations. And that's a fairly complex analysis that we've done a little bit of thinking about but haven't done sort of a full-blown analysis of. So those are the alternatives. I'm switching gears a little bit to talk about the scoping plan and what it says about local action. So I mentioned at the beginning that local action can be really critical to meeting our scoping plan goals. And one of the things that I tell local governments and regional governments when I talk to them is that many of the things that we have in the scoping plan really aren't implemented by us. They're implemented by you at the local level. And these measures are really only going to work if they can be implemented at the local level. And I actually use the waste sector as one of these, as one of the examples. So there are requirements under the legislation in 1383 for us to reduce organics that go into landfills. Well, who manages those landfills? That's mostly folks like you. And where's all that material going to go? Well, if it's going to go to an anaerobic digester or a composting facility, or if we're going to try to co-digest it with wastewater treatment facilities, those are all things that you all have oversight on in terms of permitting decisions and siting decisions and operation of those wastewater treatment facilities. And so these are all things that don't get done at the state level. These are things that get done at the local level. And it's really important for us to work with the locals and to understand what those challenges are going to be and try to figure out how to overcome some of those. And so there's very little, I think, in the scoping plan that we do at the state level that requires nothing to happen at the local level. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is looking at goals that communities can set in climate action plans and in other kinds of planning documents. What we're recommending is a long-term goal of 2 metric tons of CO2 equivalent per person in 2050. This is consistent with the 80% reduction that I talked about on the very first slide. And it's also consistent with what we call the Under 2 MOU. So the Under 2 MOU is an effort that Governor Brown, working with the state of Baden-Württemberg in Germany, sort of kicked off about a year and a half ago before the climate conference in Paris. And the goal was to get as many subnational jurisdictions as possible to sign on to commit to reduce their emissions to under 2 tons per person by 2050. And, you know, it's under two because it's an under two in terms of emissions, but also to try to keep global temperature rise to under 2 degrees Celsius. So they sort of go together. So we think that that's an appropriate target for us to set in California. And when you sort of, when you draw that line between where we are now and 2 tons per day in 2050, that's a community-wide goal of about 6 tons per person in 2030. So we're proposing that these are a good place for jurisdictions to start as they think about climate planning in their areas. We do recognize that, you know, these goals may not make sense in every area, and I'll give you an example. If you're a region that does a lot of manufacturing, or you have a lot of the industrial activity in your jurisdiction, then it may not make sense because maybe you're doing more of the energy intensive work than other areas are. And so, you know, individual jurisdictions, I think, you know, kind of need to look at this and see what makes sense. But we think that this is a good place for them to start as they think about their planning. And then beyond those plan level actions, local governments can support goals through individual projects via looking at what can be done in CEQA. So I want to talk a little bit about the economic analysis, because I think it's really important as we're looking at these really broad-based, sector-wide, economy-wide programs to think about what's going to happen to the economy going forward. So under the proposed plan, and so that's the plan that has all of the existing measures, the refinery measure and the cap and trade program, California's economy is going to continue to grow. And I think that's a really important thing to remember. The estimated impact on our economy is actually quite small when we look out to 2030. And it really, when we figure it out, it means that we're going to hit a particular place in our economic growth 3 months later than we would have. We think that's a good trade-off. We think that taking this climate action, showing this kind of climate leadership for a three-month delay in reaching our, you know, a certain level of economic growth is a good thing. The changes in GDP and employment and personal income are essentially unchanged. And then the estimated annual cost to a household, depending on what the cap and trade allowance price is, so depending on how expensive it is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, ranges from, you know, $30 to just over $200 in 2030. So they're not insignificant costs to households, but they are relatively modest costs to households as we move forward on this. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we've been working on this process for almost 2 years now. We put out the proposed scoping plan. It was, I think, the third in a series of white papers and then discussion drafts. We put out the proposed scoping plan in January of this year. We took comment through April 10th, and we are in the process of finalizing that plan for our board to consider it. So our board will be considering that plan at its June 22nd board meeting. We're planning to release the final plan so that folks can take a look at it in the late May, early June timeframe. And then we'll be moving on to implementation of the plan. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Do we have questions? Do we have speaker cards first? Okay.
I have Janet Stromberg and Jed Holtzman. I'm sorry.
Is that it? Just two? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Janet Stromberg from 350 Bay Area. I really appreciate hearing from Deputy Director Edie Chang this morning. And actually, I don't have comments. I have questions because I'm trying to understand all of this because it is very confusing. And one specific question, Edie, is when we look at, of course, the state is in flux at the legislative level about cap and trade, but would you at the moment view SB 775 as closer to one of the alternatives that you've outlined already for cap and trade? That was my first question. And then in trying to understand what covered sources are in proposed SB 775, it looked to me like they might be expanding the array of things of covered sources, but it was referring back to different statutes and it was hard to follow. But I thought that I read that the legislative analyst said it was going to cover 80% of the emissions of the whole state. So I wondered if that feeds back to the scoping plan and exactly how that all works. So I apologize for my confusion and I hope for some clarity in this process that's in flux. Thanks.
This gets lower every time. Hi there. Chair Barrett and directors, Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area. I'm convinced that this is lower than the last time I was standing here. Thank you very much to CARB staff. Been eating my spinach. So 350 Bay Area has been working a lot on the Clean Air Plan, obviously, with your staff over the last few years. And the scoping plan update provides the context in which that occurs. Really want to highlight the mention of local action and the salience of local action. As you've just heard from CARB, their graph of emissions reductions, you know, it's not just going to happen. It's going to require a lot of action at cities and counties. And, you know, we have the good fortune to also have the Air District operating in our region. So hopefully the Clean Air Plan and the Air District can be, you know, the major operator in making that graph actually happen. I just wanted to mention a couple things from our comments on the scoping plan update, which we submitted to CARB. As you might imagine, 350 Bay Area was in support of the direct regulation option, as we have typically advocated here at the Air District. Ultimately, California's most clear-cut successes in emissions reductions to date have typically come from measures like RPS and energy efficiency mandates, which involve direct interventions to reduce emissions. Also, of course, as we heard, the mention of AB 197, which we've definitely included a lot in our communications to you, those environmental justice goals are most readily fulfilled through direct California-based emissions reductions measures, as would be supported by direct emissions regulation. Wanted to just briefly talk about the economic analysis. The costs are modest, and we think the idea of paying $30 to $200 per household to preserve California and the economy and civilization is a reasonable trade-off. Nonetheless, we think that these costs might even be overestimated. So ultimately, the same was true in the Clean Air Plan, but when the health benefits or avoided health costs are characterized, they're usually quite restrictive. They might only focus on, say, emergency room visits and cancer, and not talk about the many, many other impacts of toxic air contaminants and criteria pollutants that are reflected in those same reports. So if you were to increase, you know, the health analysis and increase the measure of the avoided health costs, in theory, the economics of these plans might be even more favorable. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to respond to the question for clarification?
Sure.
Thank you.
I guess I never turned it off. So 775 is a proposal that has been introduced in the legislature that would propose statutory changes to the cap and trade program. And I should mention, the Air Resources Board is right now in the process of proposing modifications to the cap and trade program to extend it beyond 2020. And we started that process even as we were working on the scoping plan, because the cap and trade regulation is this big, complicated regulation. And we wanted to make sure that we were ready to go if we made the decision that we were going to continue with cap and trade. So if we waited until we decided and then said, okay, let's start this regulatory process, that would be a two-year process on its own. So we're in the process of proposing regulatory changes. Our board is actually scheduled to consider those changes later this year. If the legislature does pass statutory changes that would require us to modify the cap and trade program, of course, we're going to comply with state law. We would go back and make those modifications to our program. 775, as it's currently proposed, changes a number of design features in the program. So it sort of narrows the price window. Right now we have a floor, and then we have a reserve that we sell allowances off at higher prices. It's not a cap per se, but it does provide a supply of allowances at a very high price. So it sort of collapses those a little bit, and it also does away with free allowance allocation. In the cap and trade program, free allowance allocation is one of the ways that we protect against leakage. So recognizing that, for example, food processors in California are subject to increases in their energy costs, and they're subject to this requirement to purchase allowances and give them to us. So we recognize that their competitors in other states and other countries don't face those same costs. They compete in a global marketplace. And so to make sure that our businesses aren't harmed by having this program in place, what we do is we did an analysis of their trade exposure, as it were, and then we provide them free allowances based on that so that they can compensate for those costs, so they're not operating at a disadvantage compared to their competitors. So 775 would get rid of that. It looks a little bit more like a carbon tax in some of those features than like a cap and trade program. But I would say, you know, just sort of more generally, the cap and trade, the legislative process can be a long and tortuous process. And I think, you know, sort of seeing how that goes is going to be something that we're obviously paying attention to. We're trying to provide information to the legislature as they're going through those discussions right now. And then the other issue about covered sources, I will be honest, I'm not completely up to speed on what the definition of covered sources in 775 is, but I would say the cap and trade program as it's designed right now covers 85% of the emissions in California. So because it covers, when you looked at that pie at the very beginning, it covers transportation, it covers electricity, it covers industrial sources, it covers the commercial and residential sector. So it covers 85%, that's probably not exactly 85% of that pie, but it covers 85% of emissions in California. Most of the things that aren't covered are what we would think of as fugitive emissions. So things like dairies. So the manure at dairies and the cows at dairies are not covered in the cap and trade program. Landfills are not covered under the program because the methane emissions are mostly from leaks and things like that. So that, I think it's probably, I'm guessing, the same universe of covered sources that we have in our program now.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so questions or comments? Do you want to start?
Sure. Well, we're honored to have you here, and we really appreciate your time and expertise. And apparently John Joya couldn't be here today, but he regularly briefs us on what's going on. I wanted to know what the state is doing to fix the duck curve and how to fix the resources currently available in the RPS. As you know, most Bay Area communities have now started community choice energy agencies, and I've been engaged in setting up Silicon Valley Clean Energy. And one of our directors here also serves on the board. And, you know, we've come to learn that it's difficult to build new wind resources in the state, right, because of birds. And it's difficult to obtain geothermal resource. We elected to go all greenhouse gas free and optimize around that when mm-hmm. we set up ours, as opposed to worrying about the RPS. But it seems to us that the one primary resource in the RPS that we're availing ourselves of, and really the only one that we can get a lot of, is solar. And prices are falling, and it's terrific, and we're getting as much as we can, and yet we know we have a problem at the end of the day. So half of our electricity is coming from major hydro, which, of course, isn't in the RPS. So, you know, either we can sort of forget about the RPS because it's a definition that doesn't really work, because the sun doesn't always shine. Or we can look to import electricity from other states, but then we have leakage on jobs. Or we could actually fix the definition. So I'm wondering, you know, what this, I know it's probably you in combination with the legislature, but my first question is, what are your thoughts about how we address this?
I think that you're absolutely right that these are really complex issues, and it's tempting, and I think that you guys have sort of gone through the thinking on it. It's not as just simple as let's procure additional renewable resources because they're available at different times of the day. And with a lot of solar coming on, you sort of exacerbate this overgeneration or the potential for overgeneration. Right. One of the big things, and I should just say, the renewable portfolio standards is administered by the Public Utilities Commission, located here in San Francisco. And it's so for the investor-owned utilities, it's implemented by the Public Utilities Commission. The requirements for what can be counted as renewable are actually part of the statute, I think. And then for public...
Meaning it's controlled by the legislature?
Yes. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's part of the statute.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yes. Jacob says yes. And publicly owned utilities, their requirements are being they are being administered by the California Energy Commission. The California independent system operator, who actually manages the grid in California, is obviously a huge player in this too, as we're trying to figure out how we're managing all of our resources. One of the big things that everybody is looking at is how we can maximize storage. So what are the opportunities for storage? How can we try to even out that curve a little bit? That's probably not the entire answer, but that's a big piece of it. There's interest in looking at how we can use, overgeneration to, can we store it as hydrogen and use it to power transportation vehicles, for example? That's one of the things that folks have been thinking out. That's probably further out, but these are the kinds of directions that we need to be working. The other thing that I would mention is that there have been proposals to try to expand the independent system operator. So the CAISO has looked at whether there are other grids in the western United States that they can start sort of collaborating with and bringing into the process, so that instead of having to write a contract to send that electricity across, that it could be managed out sort of as one big bathtub instead of, something that you're having to transfer things across. It's, that's a really complicated issue, because then you're starting to deal with other states, you're starting to deal with other power generation, and quite frankly, in some cases, you're dealing with states that may not have the same objectives that we have. Sure. And so, I think that there has been talk, there was legislation proposed last year or on the verge of being proposed to do that. And so it's something that folks are still thinking about, but I think it's something that's probably going to take a little while for us to work through. I don't have a good and simple solution for you, except that I know that this is really hard, and there are lots of folks that are thinking about how we try to even out, how do we try to take care of that?
I mean, frankly, when we elected to optimize on greenhouse gases rather than RPS, we had no problem. We certainly fulfilled all the state obligations currently for RPS, but all the chatter is about RPS. And, if the real objective is climate change, it just seemed to us that saying, hey, in our base rate, we can supply 100% greenhouse gas-free electricity. Renewable portfolio standard, we'll meet our obligation there, but, we're trying to buy type 2 electricity to get the RPS up as high as we can, and found that to be pretty scarce. So I think there has to be some reconciliation in this matter. Let me ask another question. We have a... you talked about a carbon tax, and it feels to me like there's little will to actually impose that. We have failed so far to even extend cap and trade, if I understand correctly, in the legislature. And therefore, the market, being unsure of things, people that had had these credits for a while dumped them, as I understand it, in the aftermarket. And so we weren't able to sell much, and we didn't get much revenue. Mm-hmm. For all the programs that we would do to incentivize electrifying transportation and these sorts of things. So is it possible to do something sort of in between, like ratcheting up the floor? Because we're not charging nearly what the social cost of carbon is today. Would that not be a mechanism, something in between that would let you get to a higher level, but over time and gradually?
So there's a lot of thinking about this going on in the legislature and in, you know, the administration right now. So let me just say that, you know, first off, I mentioned that ARB has a regulation that we're working on now to extend the cap and trade program. Mm-hmm. It's actually, I would say, a point of contention, of legal debate, whether ARB has the authority to extend the cap and trade program. We believe we have the authority to extend the program post 2020, but we recognize that not everybody agrees with us. And I think what we all want is a stable climate change program. I was actually in San Francisco Tuesday.
With some certainty everybody.
Absolutely,
right?
With legal certainty.
Yeah.
And I was in San Francisco on Tuesday at it was actually an investor conference for folks they were trying to encourage folks to invest in forests as a climate change solution. And the number one thing you heard from, you know, the folks that are looking to invest money is, I want stability. I want legal stability. I want to know, you know, that this program is going to continue, and I don't want that uncertainty. And so because of that, there has been a big push in this legislative session to confirm that the program can continue post 2020. And I think you all have probably heard the governor has said he wants to get that on a 2/3 vote because he wants to take away any concern that we, you know, that is out there could this program continue? The program, we have been, under lawsuit since the program was started just about. And so he's trying to take away some of that uncertainty. So there's a lot of conversations that are going on. And I would just say my observation is that there's more conversation happening now. There's a bill in the Assembly. There's a bill in the Senate. You know, the governor has a proposal out in the budget trailer bill language. And so there's obviously a lot of conversations going on. One of the conversations has been about what is the appropriate floor price. And, you know, you could raise the floor price some.
It's like, what, $13 or something?
Right now it's like $13.50, $13.60, and it goes up 5%.
Compared to 40, 60?
To 50. Now, I do want to clarify that the cost in the cap and trade programs represents or should represent the cost to control greenhouse gas emissions. So it doesn't represent the damages. And so, you know, one of the things that we need to balance is if we can control it at a cheaper price, then what's being, you know, felt by all of us as consumers in the end is also going to be cheaper. So, you know, it's always trying to figure out, you know, what is that appropriate floor. And that's a tough decision. It's a policy call.
That's a really helpful way to think about it. I hadn't done that. So I've been convinced by some of the experts on our advisory council that it'd be really straightforward and a wonderful thing if we could impose a carbon tax in the state of California that would represent the full cost, social cost of carbon. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if we controlled for less money, that would all be good, right? Some of the members on the advisory council are concerned about leakage if we're taking action on climate that's only Bay Area wide. They're concerned about job loss, right? To the extent the state fails to establish an appropriate tax on carbon or by other means, do you think? I mean, do you advocate that we may be working with other air districts in the state, maybe working with other air districts in Oregon and Washington, try to extend the floor or a tax or whatever we do to try to minimize leakage? Or how do you see this working? Do you think we ought to be waiting for the legislature to act on some of these things, or ought we be directly trying to regulate or mitigate carbon through levies or regulations? And, you know, we have several that are on our dockets.
So. Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, I think these are really decisions that I know that you are all grappling with. And ultimately, the Bay Area Board needs to sort of figure out the best path forward. I would say that it's really important that we within California and really probably within the West need to make sure that we're coordinated on these programs and then we understand the interactions between these programs. So if we if we have a statewide cap on greenhouse gas emissions and the Bay Area adopts, you know, a regional cap on greenhouse gas emissions, what that practically means is that emissions in other parts of the state could be higher and emissions in than they would have been, and emissions in the Bay Area would might be lower than they would have been. And so overall, from a, you know, atmospheric perspective, we're not seeing anything different. And as you know, you've already mentioned leakage. It's something that you sort of have to think about in the design of that program. I think that as we're moving forward, both on greenhouse gas regulations and on criteria pollutant and toxics regulations, as we're looking at these sources, it's important that we are all working together. I think, you know, you've probably heard the Air Resources Board has talked about establishing an industrial source committee as part of the Air District, as part of CAPCOA, to work with the major districts that have refineries, looking at refineries as the first step. So working with those districts so that we can combine knowledge and understand what's happening and see, are there things, especially on the criteria pollutant and toxic side, are there things that are happening in one district that we're not seeing that same technology or level of control in another district? I think the first thing is the technology and what's out there. And then the second thing is, you know, what's the best way to make sure that those facilities are as clean as they can be?
Obviously, to the extent their health impacts, we have every incentive to
absolutely
protect our residents. To the extent we're talking about greenhouse gases, well, right, it's a global problem.
Absolutely.
And so we all want to do our part responsibly, but we also don't want to lose jobs or economic mm-hmm. activity.
Right.
And it's in that spirit, you know, I wonder how we grow our, call it a coalition of the willing.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I think we're all trying to do the same thing. And we look forward to working with the district and the district staff on this.
And my final question is, you talked about how our cap and trade is somehow linked to
mm-hmm. Quebec.
Provinces in Canada. You mentioned Quebec and you're working on Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
How can you very briefly explain how they're coupled?
Yeah. So we have what happens in the cap and trade program is there's a graph that's sort of similar to the one that I showed at the beginning, and the regulation says, here's how many allowances, here's the budget for every year that's going forward. And we set our budgets, Quebec sets their budgets, Ontario sets their budgets. And then when we auction our allowances, when we make them available, we pool them all together. Mm-hmm. So we had an auction on Tuesday. And that auction on Tuesday included allowances from California and allowances from Quebec. And so entities that are in Quebec and entities in California can all participate in this auction. And then when entities are complying with the regulation, they can submit for compliance allowances that California issued and allowances that Quebec issued. Mm. Now, a really key part of making sure that this works is making sure that the level of ambition is similar, right? So Quebec has a program where they're not actually reducing emissions, and they're just sort of, I'm going to call it like flooding the market with these allowances. Mm-hmm. That's not good because you're not creating the scarcity that you really need in the program. It turns out that Quebec, between their program through 2020, is actually more stringent than our program. So Quebec has, you know, very aggressive program. Ontario is similar in stringency to the California program. So we worked with a number of Western states and a number of Canadian provinces for probably 2 or 3 years to develop joint design principles for our cap and trade program. And the idea was that we could have, you know, this very broad-based cap and trade program where we would pool the allowances and sell them, and it would take care of some of these concerns about, you know, competition with neighboring states. When we got through with that process, other Western states have not moved forward to date. You know, there are discussions that are happening in Oregon. The legislature in Oregon is talking about, you know, they want to do something. They're trying to figure out the right path. Washington State has developed a clean air rule that takes sort of a different approach. They do impose facility-specific limits, but they allow trading in that program. So, but they are also, you know, sort of thinking about what their next steps are. So the programs are linked by these allowances that go across. And in order to execute this linkage, there's actually a requirement under state law that the governor needs to make certain findings, that the program is of similar stringency with our program, that we have enforcement, that the other jurisdiction has enforcement capability. So there's some equivalence in how we're dealing with this.
Your comments are really, and answers are really insightful. I really appreciate your coming today.
Thank you.
As far as I'm concerned, you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. I actually did want to just say, you know, you mentioned that when you developed your plans, you optimized for greenhouse gases instead of the RPS. One of the things that I should have mentioned is SB 350 requires the IOUs and the POUs to develop integrated resource plans. And the conversation about those is how do you optimize those for greenhouse gas targets? So you may have been ahead of your time in thinking about things in that way.
I mean, we're well above the state standard on RPS goals. But we just said our first mission is to be completely greenhouse gas free in our base rate.
Right.
So that's what we're doing in 11 cities in Silicon Valley today.
Great.
Yep.
Great.
Thank you.
Good to hear it.
Okay. Katie? Director Rice? Edie, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate the presentation and also your responses. So I am thinking about a few different things, but at top of mind is wearing our local government hats. You know, we all and the folks sitting on this committee, obviously, really interested and on reducing our local greenhouse gas emissions and our base carbon footprints at the local level. But what we're finding is that we're actually, and this is what I was missing from your presentation, local government is having to fight a two-front war, and especially here in the Bay Area. I think the Bay Area is probably fairly unique in that we have so many coastal communities and communities that are being impacted in their public infrastructure and their critical industry and services being impacted by sea level rise. So we are having to, right now, you know, in this moment in time, deal with sea level rise that's impacting whether it's transportation infrastructure or something else, and or plan for what's coming ahead, which takes staff resources and is going to take significant financial resources, and we don't know where the money's going to come from. At the same time that we direct our energy and thinking and staff and resources at implementing our climate action plans. And many of our 101 cities and towns are relatively small.
Right.
And so not only is there not financial resources, they're not necessarily staff resources. So I just think that that's something that ARB and our own air district has to be so mindful of, is how do we support the local governments and recognize that they're having this two-front war. We're having, as with transportation, we tend to be turning more to our own constituencies. And they're seeing taxes rising unrelated to climate change and the whole carbon thing, just because of the cost of doing business or what have you. So that leads me to the conversation around moving to a carbon tax or not, which I really like the concept of a carbon tax, but I think it could backfire psychologically, socially, because we actually need folks buying into climate change and addressing climate change. And there's something, I think a carbon tax starts to hit a consumer more directly, at least psychologically, even though any of these tools, whether it's cap and trade, the cost gets passed on to the consumer eventually. So just, that's just a thought out there. But so on the local front, I also, as I said, I think the Bay Area is unique in how many of us are coastal communities. And so what we may be feeling and do feel, I think, maybe perhaps more of an urgency. We're a progressive region as it is, but also we're feeling the impacts. And I don't know how we export that urgency. If you're an interior county, you're not going to be feeling feeling what we're feeling. So I think that's a conundrum, but I also think it's something to leverage. And that leads me to my next point, which is when you talk about, and I think AB 197 and some of the other legislation and also the thinking in the scoping plan are all about prioritization, is where do we target, what do we go for first, and the thinking around the methane gases and the short-term stuff, we need to attack that. I think that's really important, and I'm hoping that all of you have such smart, so you smart people who worked on this, it's the goals were, I mean, we're trying to meet the state goals, right, around emissions reductions. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we're recognizing that what California can do is really make an impact that ripples nationally and globally in terms of the innovation and the things that we come up with that can be exportable. And given that you said if we only have 2% of the global emissions, really the greatest impact we can have on this big battle is what can we do that will influence outward. So I think it's that. And then lastly, and I'm sorry for rambling and sort of being all over the place, is the timeline. And it all seems like it's going to be coming, you know, 2050 isn't that far away. It seems like it's far away, but not really. And 2030 is only 13 years away.
I know. Yes.
And yet things are happening so fast. And I think the role that CARB plays and that this air district plays in terms of being absolutely as aggressive as we can and doing as much as we can is really critical. And the degree to which CARB can support and our air district, because I think we are going to have to lead the way and frankly have a responsibility to. Is just critical. So I would like to see our efforts be dovetailing, and then also the recognition that we can't have these mandates at the local level without a lot of support and likely a lot of actually financial resources.
No, thank you. I think that adaptation is really a huge issue. We have a periodic meeting of the state agencies that work on climate change, and this last meeting that we had a couple weeks ago, the Ocean Protection Council presented some information from a new report about sea level rise, and it's alarming. I mean, it's very, very alarming. And so the Resources Agency is the lead agency on adaptation at the statewide level. But I think the hardest thing has really been coming up, as you said, with resources for the folks that are actually doing the planning and having to change things to figure out even what to do. I think that that's been one of the really, really big challenges. We have had conversations about, you know, we've got this money that's coming in from the auctions, and can we right now, those monies come in, they're not a fee, they're not a tax, but they have to be spent by statute to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So we are a little limited in what those funds can be used for right now. But I think it's a huge need that local governments have to be planning for these coming changes. I think other coastal communities are feeling those exact same issues.
So we just did in Marin a vulnerability analysis and assessment, and I don't remember what the number's at in terms of the cost towards mitigating sea level rise, but it's enormous. So we're just wrapping our brains around it. And I do think so when you look at the economic cost, which seems negligible and, you know,
right.
That's not talking about the adaptations that's going to have to happen.
Right.
At the same time.
And some of it is going to have to happen because we know there's going to be some sea level. It could be worse if we do nothing, but there is some that's going to happen regardless now.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Director Hudson?
Yeah. I happen to agree with the people about the forest. In fact, I keep bugging our ARB representative, I want the reforestation protocol. It was so much fun reading it the first time. That, you know, what's another 1,000 pages on the weekend? The second thing is, you talked about you're doing some things with some other areas about the cap and trade. Mm-hmm. I would just ask that you avoid Tennessee and Michigan. We are really in a competitive battle about this autonomous vehicle, connected vehicle. I have to keep reminding our CMA to stop going back there and give speeches. We don't want to tell them anything. The other thing is, you mentioned early on what's going on with the federal government. I'm actually more encouraged, not anything to do with the election. It just has to be with they're the same people back there that are at Butch Weiderlich, lunch with John Augustine. They're very pro autonomous vehicle, connected vehicle, the electric vehicle. And when I look at your graph, 35% of the greenhouse gases, transportation. I can tell you just in the last 6 months what I've seen on transportation, the movement towards electric buses, electric trucks, electric vehicles is enormous. I mean, the focus to me should be attacking the number one problem, transportation, and feed the people that want to do the autonomous vehicles. Unfortunately, that means we got to feed Rod because somebody's got to power these things or charge them up when it's needed. The last thing, one of the things drives me crazy about reading the scoping plan is you talk about finite numbers and then you talk about them with percentages and then the numbers change. And I swear when I started this thing, the goal was 427. Somewhere along the line, it went down to 396. Cap and trade was 369. Now I'm seeing 431, and we talk about percentage of these things. I wish we would go to what is really in there, and that's the per capita. You want to go from 10, which isn't even mentioned in your report. And that's basically where we're going to be, at least in 2020, down to 6. Okay, that's easy for me. It's easy because the first thing I ask from them is, where's the Bay Area?
Right.
See, we're our own little microcosm. We're hitting it. We're right around 79, 81. We're going to be there at 2020. And then drop down to 6 is going to be difficult. But, I mean, it's not looking unmanageable. What bothers me is if we're trying to get down to 431 and I look at everything that we've done and we're only down to not 431. Now I'm thinking, why are we wasting our time? I mean, and I would also ask that when you do your pie chart in here and discuss, where are we with the early discrete action that was in the initial scoping plan? We talked about all these things because, I mean, I would love to see the port go completely electric. I know we've talked about it. I know we can't afford it. But I think that when I, you know, going out of L.A. on some of these cruise ships and what a lovely port to go out of. I think that there should be something in there, but, you know, there's only so much money. And, I mean, to talk about, we're close. No, we're not. Because the reality check is it's still only 2. And if we're at 10 at 2020, and we get down to 6 million metric tons per person, and nobody else is down to 10, and I'm still on this board, well, I'd be dead by then. But I mean, I'd be screaming, why are we wasting our time and our money if nobody else is going to do it? And that's kind of what I'm hinting at here. If we're close to 10, somebody else isn't, if we're only getting down to that. And therein lies your real problem nobody's talking about. The population keeps changing, so these numbers aren't really that tough. The population just catches up to it.
Well, so part of the reason that the numbers are the way they are is because the statute's written the way it is. So the statute says get the statewide emissions down. And I do have to tell you, the reason that the 2020 target has changed is because we updated from using the second climate assessment, the IPCC assessment, to the fourth climate assessment. And so what happened was some of the global warming potentials for methane and those kinds of things changed. And so we adjusted it to reflect the fourth assessment. And we did that in 2013. And we thought this is going to confuse people because they remember this number. And I'm actually very impressed that you remember all of the numbers and you remember the discrete early actions from the 2008.
That's because I'm brain dead. I don't have a life.
Oh, that's amazing, though.
The other thing that I added, what caught my attention and why it's easier to remember, is we went to Calgary, and Canada does it differently. They're not trying to get to a 1990 level. They took 2004, and they use those same percentage. Well, we're dropping. Well, when you have a higher number, yeah, you drop further percentages to get down to the same thing. And it's that finite number that we're supposedly trying to get down to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, well, that darn California, they're not doing anything over there. Well, I know we're doing stuff here, but then I look at this number and I go, that's all we've done?
We do project we're going to hit the target, the 2020 target, early. But the other thing that I wanted to just mention is, you know, I think you're right. Ultimately, we all know that we have to motivate action in other places. And one of the things that we've been thinking about is, how do you make progress? In some places, you might not be able to talk about it as climate change. But can we talk about energy efficiency? Can we talk about energy independence? Can we talk about, you know, more domestic sources? Can we talk about reusing our waste so that we have more efficiency in our systems?
That, before you get off of that, can we talk about getting 100% of the credit for energy reduction instead of only 75% because of that leakage rule that we bring in power from other states? I mean, if I remember, trying to go back and remember something for 3 or 4 years ago, we only get credit for 75% of the energy. It's like 25% Bonneville Power or Nevada, whoever else. Oh. One of those little coal-burning states sends us something, and next thing you know, we're penalized for it. That might help. I mean, we can immediately make the number if we just get 100%.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you know, I think it's... I have a couple thoughts about what you said and the comments here. You know, I do think it is unfortunate that, well, it's fortunate and unfortunate that we're in the vanguard in that we are leading this fight and we're doing it pretty well. But we do need to bring others along. You know, if we just do it alone, that's not going to work. But on the other hand, we can't control them. You know, all we can do is lead by example.
Right.
And I think part of that example has to be making this economically viable. And I really do hear that that is going to be the next big problem with moving this forward. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I have a few questions which kind of all lump together with this issue. On your second to the last slide, it says that the estimated annual cost to California households is $30 to $214. How would households experience that cost?
Really, mostly in energy costs. So that's really so there might be some increase in the manufactured cost of things that you purchase in California, although I mentioned we're providing, you know, free allowances to try to offset some of that, but it's really in your energy costs. One of the things that we do to try to protect consumers in California is, utilities actually get free allowance allocation, but they get it on behalf of their ratepayers. So they don't get it for the utility. They get it on behalf of the ratepayers, and under the terms of the regulation, they have to use it to benefit the ratepayers. If you are an investor, if you live or you get your electricity in an investor-owned utility service area, you actually receive a climate credit every year on your, it's actually twice a year on your bill. It ends up being about $60 a year. And that's money that, you know, is from the allowances that the utilities get. They sell those allowances in the auction, and then they send that money back to the ratepayers to compensate them for the increased cost of the program. So we are looking for ways to try to minimize the cost to consumers as much as we can.
Okay, because I do think that I really agree with Director Rice about the costs to local governments mm-hmm. to go forward on this. There has to be some way of addressing that because local governments are just being hit by everything, including CalPERS, which at least for my jurisdiction is going to be enormous. And I can't believe we're the only ones there, but we really are trying to address that early, or at least as early as now. Maybe we should have been doing that before, but we haven't. So, you know, how this... I think you can do a lot to psychologically improve people's effect on this by doing some kind of that where people feel like they're getting something repaid to them through these cap and trades, mm-hmm. You know, at a consumer level, you know, and that in large part is reframing, in large part is actually parsing out where all the costs are in the things that we do and the things that we buy. And I know that Director Ross has always been very big about that. And I really think we need to really sell that idea so that people do understand the choices they make and somehow they can get something back. And I'm not sure how that works, but I do think it does need to work because we have so many things that we keep saying we're going to do as a state, but it gets implemented on the regional level. Well, you know, when I have a big development coming before my town and they're not doing anything about solar, well, you know, it's a mitigation, but you have to really push it because it's not actually legally required.
Right.
You know, so that we need to get these things so that cities can legally require them and, you know, update their standards and things like that so that we are all on the same page and being able to get things better. I can't remember if it was yesterday's meeting where someone brought up the idea of point of sale changes in, you know, the existing stock of housing, that things don't go forward without coming up to energy efficient standards. And that's hugely resisted, you know, by the real estate people, if no one else. But we really do need to make this so that the people who really do like living in California and want to be here and want to do what we do are also not feeling that they're the only ones paying the price for it.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's an issue. In your proposed scoping plan scenarios, you talked about refineries are the biggest emitters, these toxic emitters, and then you're talking about leakage, and you know, we had a discussion about this at our general meeting yesterday. You know, it is somehow we have to make a very good argument as you know, the guardians of clean air about it's not okay just to pay the fines. I mean, these massive fines that companies pay rather than putting that money proactively into solving the problem before it happens. And I think that that is really an important discussion to be having with those with that industry, you know, because I don't think the leakage issue to me is just a lack of political will, not a lack of economic ability, you know, in that area. So, okay, is there anyone else who has anything to say? Okay, well, thank you very much.
You
clearly generated a lot of comments, and good luck.
Thank you.
So Plan Bay Area 2040.
Yes, Chair Barrett, as we continue with our plan focus for this morning's meeting, next up we have Ken Kirky, who's the Director of Planning for the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and he'll give an overview on the update to Plan Bay Area, the Sustainable Community Strategy for the Bay Area. Ken.
Good morning, committee members. I should know how to do that. Happy to be here. Apologies to committee member Hudson and Rice to the extent they've already heard this presentation. A couple of times I've tried to make it more specific to the issues at hand here.
We've forgotten it, though, already, so.
Okay, that makes me feel better, kind of. So, Plan Bay Area 2040 is the Regional Transportation Plan and Sustainable Community Strategy for the Bay Area. It's governed by both federal and state statutes, including SB 375, which is related to the greenhouse gas reduction target that we are given by the Air Resources Board. Relative to the very ambitious plan that the Air District just adopted, there is overlap, but there is a big difference as well. I think the easiest way to describe it is that Plan Bay Area is kind of a piece of the puzzle, both of the clean air plan that the Air District adopted and of the scoping plan. We have a fiscally constrained transportation and land use plan, so we are required to include any major transportation project moving forward in the Bay Area through 2040. It's in the plan. We assess those projects. We do look at them relative to performance targets that relate to the environment. We've been pretty ambitious on that front relative, I would say, to really any other region. And we have been able to achieve our per capita greenhouse gas reduction of 15% by 2035. It's actually 16% in the draft plan that we have out for review right now. in ways that are probably not surprising to any of you, during this era, the greenhouse gas component aspect of the plan is and will continue to be an important consideration, but a lot of the discussion has been around the region's housing crisis and to some extent what that means for vehicle miles traveled, but also what it means for equity and impacts on communities and families and so forth. So when we started the update of the plan a few years back, in part what we did is we looked at where the region is relative to when the first plan was adopted in 2013. As you all know, the region's been experiencing a lot of growth, over 500,000 jobs between 2011 and 2015, but only 65,000 housing units during that same period. That's one house for every 8 jobs created. That's a pretty significant disparity. One of the issues that's become very apparent at the commission, at the Transportation Commission, is that this economic boom, the disparity between housing growth and housing location and job growth and job location, is that it has put enormous strains on the transportation system in the region. We've seen record ridership on Caltrain and BART. We've also seen record congested delay. Even going back to the dot-com period, congested delay is at an all-time high, and that's essentially delay when you're sitting on the freeway and the cars are moving at a rate of 35 miles per hour or less. That's when the freeway system really gets bogged down, becomes very inefficient, and it also becomes particularly inefficient in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Thus far, in terms of updating the plan, we've had a lot of public workshops, we've had open houses, we've had public meetings. We released the draft plan and the draft EIR on March 31st. We have a public comment period that's a couple of months long. It goes through June 1st. In terms of the growth distribution for the plan calls for 820,000 new households through 2040. Nearly half would be in the three largest cities of San Jose, San Francisco, and Oakland. Roughly a third in the Bayside cities and communities around the Bay, and about 20% would be in the cities and towns in the inland parts of the region. You may be familiar with the priority development areas. These are transit-served infill areas that are nominated by local governments, they're adopted by the regional governments, they've been supported through planning grants and some incentives around transportation funding. Roughly 3/4 of the growth going forward would be in these areas, with the balance outside of those areas. In terms of employment, we expect about 1.3 million new jobs. The pattern is focused, but not as focused as the housing pattern that is included in the plan, and that is in part because our existing base of employment is not nearly as focused. And this is a particular issue in the South Bay, on the peninsula, in the inland part of the East Bay, where we have very large office parks that are not in priority development areas. They are not immediately adjacent to transit. This is a transportation challenge for the region. We do think it may be an opportunity for the region going forward as some of those areas are redeveloped, not to be confused with redevelopment, but they are rebuilt as places that are mixed use. Places with housing, as well as jobs, as well as commercial and other amenities. There's probably some very good opportunities there for the region in terms of the economy, in terms of quality of life, but also in terms of GHG reductions as we move forward. The RTP, the Regional Transportation Plan through 2040, includes $303 billion in funding. That's from federal, state, regional, and local sources. It's important to note that in this region, the bulk of the funding is at the local and regional level. The counties in the region, in particular, have done a really good job of raising money over the years. The voters have stepped up again and again and again to support transportation investments that have not been supported in the same way at the federal level in particular. We don't see that probably changing in the near term. There is good news, as you probably all know, on the state front with SB 1. In terms of the distribution of funding in the plan, this is very much a fix-it-first plan. Roughly 90% of the funding would go toward maintaining or improving existing systems. That's both roads as well as transit, as well as modernizing existing systems. There's a considerable amount of money that would be going to the BART system, to our major transit systems in particular, to bring them up to a state of good repair. They are, as you probably all know, at a point right now where they are at the end of their useful life in terms of rolling stock, in terms of train control. All of that needs to be replaced. So that's a priority in the plan. Our plan is notable, particularly when considered relative to the other regional transportation plan, sustainable community strategies in the state, and that we have moved very aggressively and to a significant degree in partnership with the Air District on a climate initiatives program. SB 375 does not allow for the accounting of changes in technology. PAVLI, different regulations, that's not part of SB 375. SB 375 is related to how much we all drive, automobiles, light trucks, driving down VMT, and capturing acceleration in the use of new technologies. If we can demonstrate that we have programs that are advancing the acceleration of the use of electric vehicles, bicycles, etc., we can capture that in our target, and we have very aggressively tried to do so. On the electric vehicle front, we have a fee-based program, charger program, purchase incentive program with the Air District. The same is true relative to bike share and and bike infrastructure, car sharing programs, the commuter benefits ordinance, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. A couple of new initiatives that we are advancing going forward relate to really driving down vehicle miles traveled in a more direct way and getting to suburban locations in particular. We are funding a trip caps program. This is based on the model that has been used by Stanford. It's been used by Facebook, by LinkedIn, where the local communities have set a maximum cap in terms of the number of trips that a facility can take on, regardless of the number of new employees or visitors. It places a requirement on a location or an entity, a business, to come up with alternative strategies for employees. There's been a great deal of success, particularly in Santa Clara County, with this model, and so we're funding a suite of ordinances that would be available to local jurisdictions to put these trip caps in place and hopefully lead to more widespread use of them going forward. The plan is very much a performance-based plan, and I'm going to focus in on the climate protection target, since that is the theme of the day. We do achieve the 15% target. We exceed it by 16% in the draft plan. What we don't do well in the plan going forward is really accounting for the impacts on people in terms of the costs of living in the region related to housing and transportation. Our analysis shows that looking at housing and transportation with the bulk of the costs being related to housing, that for households in the lower 50% of the income spectrum in the Bay Area, that we're spending an already really high percentage of 54% of their household income on housing plus transportation 2005, that even with the draft plan, even with additional resources, even with getting this level of housing built, the costs are so extreme in this region, and the resources for affordable housing, the intensity of the chronic housing shortage over the decades has put us in a position where we expect that this will actually get worse over time. As a result, the Commission and the ABAG Executive Board have done a couple of things. One is to really hone in on this issue. Section 1 of the plan really outlines the challenges we face today on this front. Section 2 gets into what the plan is, its basic framework. Section 3, what we expect in the future relative to land use and changes in growth as well as transportation. Section 4 outlines the performance framework. And Section 5 gets into three key areas, which I'll touch on in a moment, particularly housing, and really trying to change the trajectory on that issue, of really trying to get under that issue and see if we can make a difference, because the impact on future generations will be so extreme if we do not. In addition to housing, the other two areas where we are off trajectory with the plan are economic development and resilience. The economic development portion of the action plan is largely focused on the creation of middle-wage jobs. The analysis shows the facts on the ground are that not everyone in this region is going to be a software engineer. Not everyone goes to college. And in a high-cost region, we need middle-wage jobs for people to move into. This focus area is about that. It's particularly related to middle-wage jobs related to goods movement and freight, and hopefully clean goods movement and freight, particularly along some of the rail corridors in the East Bay. The resilience component is about a couple of key items. One is continuing to prepare for earthquakes and hazards, particularly in terms of homes and businesses in the region, to harden private property to some extent the way that public facilities have been for earthquakes and other events in the future. But it's also about the issue of climate adaptation that has already been touched on this morning. There's a lot of good work going on in the region. There's a lot of good work being led by our partner BCDC. Yet there still is not, generally speaking, a coherent approach to dealing with climate adaptation and sea level rise. There's still an enormous need for financial resources for local jurisdictions. And this is just going to accelerate over time, and we think it needs to be a primary focus. So that is another key part of the action plan. As I mentioned, we've had a lot of outreach. We had a meeting across the atrium here last night in San Francisco. We have meetings coming up in Marin, in San Jose, and in Santa Rosa this weekend and next week. That said, this is a big region, and this is an online plan, and we are encouraging people and cities and entities to respond online, to view it online. Everything is available there. And the comment period again goes through June 1st. And we are looking to adopt the adoption by MTC and ABAG in late July. Before I close, I just want to mention one other item that is related to the earlier discussion and the next discussion, and that is that in April, the Commission made a recommendation to the Air Resources Board, in coordination with MPOs in San Diego, Los Angeles, and Sacramento, to increase the per capita greenhouse gas target for the next plan to 18% from the current 15% per capita. They did so with a number of conditions related to financial resources, related to potential pricing strategies, related to automated vehicles, a whole series of issues that will require coordination with the Air District, coordination with the Air Resources Board, the staffs of both agencies. I think that's something we'll be talking with you a lot more about. It offers some, I think, pretty exciting opportunities to do some things differently, but the conditions were also based upon the fact that we believe that on the land use front, which, as you know, all of you at the local level is challenging and moves slowly when you've got a big region with a big existing base. Given the relatively limited level of resources coming from the state to support the implementation of the plans, given the lack of regulation around automated vehicles, given some of the challenges around pricing, we really need to work cooperatively, and we need to get more resources and more authority around certain issues if we're really going to be able to achieve what is a pretty aggressive target on top of what we're already achieving. So I think that's a stay tuned item. With that, I will stop, and I'm happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Katie.
Ken, thanks. I've never seen that presentation before.
I hope you enjoyed it.
It was, I've seen variations, but it was excellent. So
thanks.
Thank you. A couple questions, and you may not have the answers. So when we look at the housing issue and we dive into the data, do you know what the home ownership sort of statistics are at in terms of, you know, what percentage of the population is owns their own home and what percentage are renters generally, and is there any trend tracking there?
You know, I don't know the most recent statistics. I know that since the recession, it dropped down in terms of the home ownership percentage is lower than it once was, and it hasn't come back up, is my understanding, even with the boom. There has been more rental housing built as a percentage of housing in the region, and there are also a lot of people who post-recession just have not been able to get back into the home ownership market, and a lot of people coming into the region, even if they're well paid, and many of the people coming into the region are well paid, that down payment is so enormous in the Bay Area that I think that also impedes people from buying property. So it's trending downward at this point.
I think that's one of those numbers and societal trends. It matches up a little bit with the 99.1% sort of phenomenon, and it's something for us all to be aware of. You know, property ownership is the key, and if you are never able to get into that property ownership, home ownership position the way our society works today, it's a challenge. So then the other trend I was curious about was, in historically, when unemployment is real low and the job market gets real tight that way, you see industry or you see the job creators move out. And because eventually they're unable to attract worker, they can't find the workers they need. Are we seeing that people are willing to actually commute, have a longer commute and spend more money on just have a lower quality of life in order to have that job than we have in the past? Because it seems to me that I would have thought that at some point we'd stop creating all the jobs in San Francisco, or maybe the jobs here do pay well enough so that those folks can manage, and it's the displacement factor we're seeing. But I'm just, any comments sort of on the job growth and the way the market, the labor market's responding to what's going on here?
I think, the phenomena we're seeing, and it's arguably pretty troubling, is one of churn, where we're seeing overall job levels go up, but we're also seeing a contraction of the jobs in the middle. And you can name firms from Charles Schwab to Union Bank to Jamba Juice, et cetera, that have either moved out of the region or moved their mid-level jobs, in most cases, out of the region, because those folks can make a better, they can have a higher quality of life, arguably, on some levels, in lower-cost regions. So there's essentially a swapping that occurs for people who can afford to be here. We see the high-income jobs expanding, low-income jobs expanding somewhat, middle-income jobs contracting, and that plays out in terms of the mix of households in the region. And it's something that's happening fairly rapidly. It's probably most acute in this city, in San Francisco, but we see it expanding to other counties going forward. And I think that's one of the real challenges relative to housing and jobs going forward. For those of us who've been at this a little while, for a long time, the mantra was, if we don't build enough housing in the Bay Area, our economy is going to fall apart. We're not really seeing that per se. What we're seeing is it's hyper-selective about who gets to be here and who doesn't, or what their quality of life is like if they stay here and are not of tremendous means. So I think that's one of the things that's really gotten the attention of the commissioners and the executive board members over this past couple of years, is this trend is intense and it's different. And when we analyze going forward to 2040, and there will be declines, of course, in the economy at different points, but you have a couple more cycles like this, and it's kind of daunting in terms of thinking what the impact would be like on those generations coming forward.
And then finally, on the jobs front, I know that, one of the things that 375 does is it does try to link jobs and housing growth. So, e.g., the PDAs and where you're seeing most of the housing growth and most of the jobs growth in the big job centers, except that there's not a specification that the jobs that are being created actually meet the kind of housing that's being created, and we have some control problem. It feels like we have a lot more control over housing growth, and we tend to suppress it, and we tend to allow for the intense job growth. So the jobs housing linkage stuff. So if we're not ready to step up and actually really link jobs and housing, then at least there needs, I feel like, and I could be wrong on this, but it given the impact on our transportation infrastructure, whether it's just road, you know, the impact on our roads because of the increased traffic and or the pressure, the demand on our public transportation, where do the job creators, are they stepping up and helping us to maintain those systems that actually move people around? And that's probably a Prop 13 question.
I think it probably is in part. I mean, we've had more interaction with the business community and actual industries through the course of this plan update than we have before, which is encouraging. I think a lot of the major industries in the region, they're aware of the housing crisis. They express concern about it. They are in part looking for a little bit more coherence or consensus in terms of what does the region want to see happen before they dive into what is, you know, as you know, a very fraught political dynamic. I think if there was more of a focus on we need these things to happen to help solve this problem, there's probably sufficient interest on their part in really trying to be a part of the solution. But without something laid out before them, there's no upside for them to dive into that discussion.
And it could be, I mean, having just come from Europe and ridden around on the transportation systems there, I mean, to me, if you can't get the housing close to the jobs, then you got to amp it up on the public transportation. And it seems to me that that's where we, and I know where MDC is trying and SB 375 is trying, but there's only so many much monies, but it seems like that's where we have to get to that next level.
My name is Rod Sinks. I'm a council member in the city of Cupertino. We live in a transit desert in my city. There's almost no effective facilities. The new VTA plan is going to improve things some, right, with more frequent service and fewer routes. So we think ridership will go up. But I mean, frankly, from the perspective of cities around where I am, transit has utterly failed us. And you know, I think we have a chicken and egg problem. We've consistently passed sales tax after sales tax, and now, you know, some of the cities in Santa Clara County are up at the state maximum 10%. And frankly, a sales tax is a regressive thing, right? So for those folks that are just trying to make do, more and more taxes on everything they buy can be a real hardship. Do you see the Bay Area, you know, and frankly, the businesses seem to enjoy working to campaign for sales taxes, but not so much for employer taxes. I know that in Oregon, there are no sales taxes. And in fact, the TriMet system that's actually has good fare box recovery and is effectively utilized, their operating costs are funded solely on, there's no sales tax, it's funded solely on an employer tax of about 0.73%. Do you see us moving to this model? Or how would we get to the point where if we really do have a situation where we have a lot of employers that are affluent, and their employees are affluent, but damn, we've got dozens of them now running their own private buses. But how do our school teachers get to work and other folks that can't take these facilities in my city? We got lots of buses. It's just they're going to Apple, right? Or they're transiting up the expressway to Google. But that's not a transportation system that serves everybody. And we have 5 hours of rush hour traffic on 85 and 280 each way every day. Coming from San Jose and Point South, how do we begin to build a system that actually moves people other than employees in fancy corporate buses? Do you have any thoughts on how we amp this up and get some solutions? Because, I mean, the reaction, right, for all these good urban planning concepts we have, the reaction in cities like mine is now one of NIMBYism. I got mine. We don't need anybody else in our city. We don't need anybody else in our region. We're just going to pull up the drawbridges and, you know, we don't even, some people are on our local councils are even saying we don't need jobs here anymore. which is really nuts to me, but, you know, our failure to fix this in the public sector, as other urban areas do as they grow, and Portland is actually a pretty small example compared to the Bay Area, but they seem to be getting the job done. What do we need to do differently here?
I think a big part of our challenge you've touched on, and this is not in any way to pick on the South Bay or Silicon Valley. The region is fortunate to have Silicon Valley by any measure.
Yeah, of course.
It's what, you know, every other region in the world literally has tried to get it, and we still have it. That's a good thing. But I think that the origin and destination challenge that's been created by the land use pattern, mm-hmm. particularly in Santa Clara County, is unlike really anything else in any major region in the world, where you have these major employment centers that are dispersed and a fairly low density level of residential development. It's just very, very difficult to serve by transit. I think it's been trending in the right way in terms of the type of development. And there are campuses such as Google, North Bayshore, and Mountain View that, you know, LinkedIn, et cetera, that are working with that city to really transform that place. That's something that probably can be served by transit much better in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But dealing with it at that level is going to be critically necessary. I think that's one piece. In terms of the taxes and fees, MTC with ABAG and a bunch of public-private nonprofit entities are launching an effort known as CASA, and it's focused on really trying to address the region's chronic housing shortage, and essentially comes from a baseline of we've had 30 years of lots of talk and lots of attempts at changing things, and things have actually gotten worse. So what will it really take to make a difference? It's going to kick off, it looks like, in late June. And it's in part to get to the revenue question and to get to the employer question in terms of, you know, there has been limited discussion, but some discussion in the region around what about for major employers that aren't well served by transit? What if there was some type of jobs housing linkage fee that was regional that they paid into, would not impact their bottom line in a serious way, but in aggregate could create a chunk of funding for better transit and for housing near transit that we just don't have right now? It might be a way for them to really demonstrate that they were part of a regional solution, but also create some real money without having a regressive tax or fee on low-income residents, which is one of the things when we look at the higher GHG target that we're recommending to ARB, which we absolutely want to do, but when we look at a VMT fee and think about its potential impact on low-income drivers or low-income households, it's phenomenally regressive.
Yeah.
It's much to do anything that would move the needle at all in terms of driving down the desire to drive. The price per gallon is enormous. And
we'd have to have effective transportation where we'd ask transit, where
right.
we'd ask people to get out of their cars, right?
Yes, and it is a particular challenge in the most suburban communities where there are a lot of job centers. I think that's one of the big tasks we have ahead is really trying to deal with that more directly and better.
I worked in Portland about 10 years ago, and like many tech businesses, they weren't in downtown Portland. We were on the west side of town, Beaverton and Hillsboro. Mm-hmm. And Intel has three major fabs up there. There's Nike there. There's all kinds of little tech companies. So it's not wholly unlike Silicon Valley, where you have, you know, a major housing center, which is downtown Portland and the city to the east, and then a lot of people are coming out west every day. But somehow they've gotten the job done, and they have actually half the density that VTA has on a per capita basis. So it seems like there must be answers. Do you foresee? I see in the discussions between counties and services a lot of siloing that goes on. It seems like one transit agency in some cases is competing with another or can't imagine serving those other folks. Does it make sense for the region to have 27 or 28 or whatever it is different transit agencies? And is there something we could do to say, let's try to smack these things together. Because, you know, other metro areas, not all of them, right, but a lot of them are well served by master planning that goes on. Maybe it takes some of the politics out of it, or, you know, we could actually build something more effective if we were looking more globally at the region.
There, to my knowledge, has not been any successful effort or even very robust effort to consolidate the transit agencies. And I think there are a lot of logistical kind of local level concerns and ownership over transit in a county or community. But there's also labor related concerns for what is still largely a bus dominated transit system. Got some agencies that pay a lot more than others, and when you consolidate things, that becomes a big issue. Mm-hmm. There are significant efforts right now underway to help reconcile a lot of what the challenges are. Some of them are modest but important, like actually having a regional transit map that somebody landing at SFO or Mineta or Oakland could read, and they would know how to get around. We're doing that now, and we hope to have that available, I believe, in early 2018, and widespread use of that and so forth. Clipper, the fare card, is being upgraded. Clipper 2.0 is underway, and one of the considerations is looking at when you change from, say, VTA to Caltrain, making sure you don't get dinged in terms of your fare, which is a really important consideration for a lot of people. So that will be a big improvement. We've also had a core capacity transit study underway, and that's in the central part of the region, but it's really looking at transit in and out of San Francisco and the East Bay and the Peninsula, and it's been a cooperative effort with BART, AC Transit, Muni, the ferries, the bridge, Caltrain, etc. And it's been a really good process, and I think part of the reason it's been successful is because in this era of, you know, rapid increases in ridership, AC Transit and BART are no longer competing for passengers. They're actually in the position of saying, no, you take some of them, and have been willing to really work together. And we have recommendations coming out of that, some of which are in the plan in terms of prioritized investments that would work together. So I think there's progress on that front. I don't think it necessarily requires a merging of agencies, but it does require coordination. And I think... arguably, in the South Bay, there may be more work that needs to be done, and perhaps with BART coming in and hopefully Caltrain actually getting electrified and some other things occurring, there might be a better basis to do that.
Well, I really appreciate your responses. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Director Avi.
Thank you. So I come from Mountain View, and it sounds like you're very familiar with what we are doing in our North Bay Shore area. And we're still in the process of studying the plan. But some of the things that I'm discovering is this issue of jobs or housing near jobs, something we are trying to do. We're significantly adding, potentially adding housing near the jobs. But it's in an area that has no transit. And so even though vehicle miles traveled within the area might be lessened, there's still the spillover, not everybody who works there will live there by choice too. Our internalization rate right now is about 27%, and we see even in higher urban areas like San Francisco, I think the highest is maybe 40%, there's always going to be spillage. And so my gripe with the process all these years has been how the jobs housing ratio has been done by cities. And the reality is that, yeah, you could build for everybody who works in your city, but by choice, people aren't necessarily going to live there. So, you know, how do a community like us, who I think, you know, we've done a lot over the years and we're going to be doing a lot more, but we can't do it alone. And we talk about these issues being regional, but the reality is there's not a lot happening regionally. Like, what can we really expect to see at the regional level that will improve the situation, the quality of life for our residents? But in this situation, what we're seeing is vehicle miles traveled within, you know, the community might be less, but we're going to see gridlock on 101 from Santa Clara all the way to East Palo Alto is what our EIR is showing. So, like, what can we expect to see an improvement rather than a degradation of our quality of life?
I'll just say, first of all, I think we do hold up what Mountain View is doing as an example of, you know, what should happen around the region, because the transformation of the North Bayshore area holds so much promise in terms of really taking on this dynamic directly, and we find it encouraging. When we went to the Air Resources Board in March for a discussion about the new GHG target, I felt like the board, there was a very good discussion, which was impressive to me because they had been there all day long and they still engaged on the topic. And I also had the sense that they understood that the regions have been working really hard, local jurisdictions have been working aggressively to really try to drive down VMT and GHG, and that there was a need for more state resources, there was a need for more state coordination. One of the things that board member and Professor Dan Sperling focused on was both trying to bring together a group of folks around the state to address these kinds of issues and not just have it be a numbers game, but really figure out what could make a difference, with a lot of the focus being on first mile, last mile transit connections, which I think, you know, on the peninsula in western Santa Clara County is really important, because if Caltrain is modernized and can take on a lot more capacity, that's really important. But getting to and from it is such a huge issue for so many employers up and down that corridor. Mm-hmm. I think that could hold a lot of promise and could be a focus of future regional funding, because it's one of the areas where we could, if we can get these things to work together, along with getting an HOV, HOT lane on 101 to really move, you know, a lot more mm-hmm. high capacity vehicles up and down that corridor efficiently, it could really make a difference. And so, you know, I think there is some potential there to work with communities on the peninsula in the South Bay around those issues and other parts of the region too, to address that first mile, last mile issue, which in the Bay Area, especially suburban parts of the region, is such an impediment to people using transit. It just doesn't make it efficient for people to try to make transit their choice.
And I would argue we just need more transit. That's not just Caltrain, but Director Sinks and I share the 85 corridor, and there are just many other corridors that we need to have transit options for. And I hope that we can see those types of resources coming our way.
Thank you.
Just going to jump in on this, saying that I'm from Sonoma County, and it's not just South Bay area. You know, we're not exactly a desert, and there is, you know, the promise that SMART is actually has released their schedule, but cool. That is a schedule that has so many problems with the first and, you know, getting to and getting from. Yeah. You know, it stops a half a mile from the Santa Rosa Airport, which, by the way, you need to include in your map that's coming out in 2018, how people can get to that, because that's expanding and that's getting used regionally quite a bit. And people need to know how they can get there other than driving. But I really agree with my fellow directors that there needs to be a lot more regional work done, and we're not seeing it in my area either. This comment about the first and last mile, I think that is really important, but there are just so many other connections that, you know, if they don't go along the spine, don't happen. Now, I know going along the spine is great, and that's where I think your comments about talking to the businesses about, you know, when they relocate or when they reconstruct their campuses, you know, that those issues have to be dealt with. I like your discussion about the housing job linkage fee, but that's really in the future. I mean, even if that money were collected tomorrow, it would still be 5 years before you'd start to see anything that happens. At least two people have brought up the whole notion of the private bus use. I know that you guys have had political discussions with these people, but there really does need to be more service for the actual population that pays the taxes for the roads that those buses go on.
Amen.
And that they do not get any value from. They must have an empty seat, or maybe they can run an extra bus in order to serve other people who don't work at those companies but travel a similar route. I think that that's a very bad political precedent, and I think that that's an area where we have really missed the boat in taking a much more popular stand for decreasing greenhouse gases and other miles traveled. If more people on the bus, the better it is, and that really is something I think we could do now. Okay, thank you for your presentation.
You.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Do you have public cards? Yes, I'm sorry that I just jumped right in front of you guys. But,
that's okay. I have Jed Holtzman and Janet Stromberg.
Okay. At least we can apologize to you guys because you'll be back again.
Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area, and we would always prefer to hear your conversation first anyway because it makes our comments more rich. Really want to support everything that you said as Bay Area residents. Transit, we're spoiled compared to, I grew up in Houston. At the same point, it's not where it needs to be and not where it needs to be to meet CARB's goals and the Air District's climate goals. As a San Francisco resident, it's not clear to me how spending two-thirds of your income on housing and transportation is a sustainable community. And so to the extent that this very intense planning effort has been engaged for so long, it's upsetting to see that we're not getting to where I think we collectively agree that we need to go, especially when we've seen the Air District put forward this amazing 2050 vision that we're sure that we're going to meet. I would urge you all to reach out to your colleagues on the MTC board. I believe actually some of your director colleagues are on the MTC board, but also from your own counties, you have folks who are on the MTC board, and it seems like they would be a great place to direct the comments. My main comment is going to be about what I know best as a longtime San Francisco resident. I see Bayside cities and towns have created one housing unit for every 15 jobs in the last few years. And we see also that the percentage of jobs in that region, in that part of the region, is estimated to stay the same through 2040, yet 33% of the new housing is going there, while 46% is going in the three big cities. As a resident of one of those three, this is alarming to me. The changes that have already happened since 1999 when I moved to San Francisco have been nearly fatal to the cultural life of the city as we knew it, and that's why it's in publications all over the country and the world talking about San Francisco and the effect that the economy has had on the city, the boom, which we're thankful for. We are already carrying the load, disproportionately, I would argue, for the cities in Silicon Valley that have created these huge corporate boom in the last few years. And the idea that we would increase the disproportionality there by building more housing in San Francisco and San Jose while allowing the same amount of the job load in the region to stay in these Bayside cities and allow them to maintain their neighborhood quality of life seems crazy to me. The increase in congested delay presented here and the increase in the average commute time presented here are totally correlated in time to this boom that we've experienced since about 2012, and they're not correlated with a commensurate increase in transit ridership because, as we've heard from the directors, the jobs in these towns are not located near transit in many cases. So I'm not sure that this is really addressing the issue in terms of we're still sending people up and down large swaths of land to reach their job. We need to have them living near their jobs. And my time is up. Thank you.
Janet Stromberg, I'm not speaking for 350 Bay Area, and I thought I'd also let you know I sit on the City of Berkeley's Energy Commission, and this is one of the issues that we look at in joint interest with our Transportation Commission. I think there's a parallel here, perhaps, between the issue of addressing climate change in areas that are not ready to look at it when we look at building out clean energy instead of saying you have to stop doing this and stop doing that. And on the transportation front, talking about quality of life, number one, and not you have to get out of your car, number two. I'm interested to look at this. It's a very short presentation, but I see that there are projections for housing needs for 2040. But when it comes to talking about transportation, there's a graph that stops very short of even where we're at now. And I didn't hear a comprehensive addressing or proposal of what we're going to do about all this congestion. And if the housing is going to, if we're going to have a million more people here, they have to move around. And I think the time has long since passed that we can do it in a piecemeal approach with 27 different agencies. I was very interested to hear Director Sink's idea about an employer tax. I think that we also need to think about equity with regard to our transportation employees, as well as we talk about equity in housing and equity in jobs and things like that. We need a regional transportation approach with our agencies much more interconnected, if not unified. For that, we need state change, state legislation. And with regard to the different pay scales of the employees, they all live in the Bay Area. They all suffer the same costs that we all suffer, and they all ought to get a fair wage. That is not a reasonable objection to not putting our transit agencies together. And speaking as a Berkeley resident, I know that the I-80 corridor, 880 right in front of me, from Oakland to Richmond, is one of the highest traveled in the entire nation, and it's been that way for a very long time. So there are plenty of people on the major corridors, not in transportation, because our transportation's maxed out. And this plan needs to say how we're going to go beyond the level of service that we have right now to address all the needs that we have. I think people want it, and I don't think it's a matter of how much gas costs. I think they actually want it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any more public comments? Okay, so now we are on to implementation of the 2017 Clean Air Plan.
Yes, Chair Barrett. Staff is prepared to do this. It is 11:45, so just wanted to do a little bit of a time check. Should we proceed?
Are you okay? How long do you think it'll run?
No, the presentation.
Your presentation.
I can do it quickly.
No, I'm not asking you to do that. I'm just asking you how long are you prepared?
8 minutes?
That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Great. Right. So this is Abby Young. She's our manager of our climate protection section, and she'll talk about the work we're doing. The board adopted the Clean Air Plan last month, and we have been and are continuing to implement it, but she's going to give you sort of an overall picture of our steps to implement the plan.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the committee. And as I mentioned, I'll try to move through this fairly quickly. As you know, last month, the board adopted this Clean Air Plan. It's a multi-pollutant strategy that addresses criteria pollutants and local toxic air contaminants, as well as greenhouse gases. But this being the Climate Protection Committee, my presentation will focus on the greenhouse gas components of the plan. So the plan articulates a vision that looks toward long-term goals to achieving clean, healthy air for all Bay Area residents, as well as achieving deep reductions in greenhouse gas emissions consistent with the state's and the air district's adopted climate protection targets. What the plan does is it focuses on the nearer term objectives to help get us on the pathway to achieving those longer term goals. So these objectives that the plan focuses on are things like moving quickly to reduce what we call super greenhouse gases like methane that have a very strong ability to force climate change. Also looking at how we can dramatically reduce and begin switching away from fossil fuel combustion by looking at both reducing combustion region-wide, but also reducing our demand for fossil fuels and moving to cleaner and more renewable forms of energy. And of course, we have a wide variety of tools here at the Air District that we can use to help achieve those objectives. Now, the plan focuses on many different economic sectors, and we have a total of 85 different control measures in the plan spanning all these economic sectors, and then those 85 control measures can be broken down into 282 discrete implementation actions. So there is a lot on our plate, and it behooves us to really think about how we're going to implement this plan strategically. So the first thing we want to do is think about priorities. And the plan is so expansive and so comprehensive that we really can't do a rigorous, detailed quantitative analysis of each of those 282 implementation actions, but we can do a good qualitative analysis, and that's what staff is engaged in right now. We're thinking about each of these implementation actions in terms of bang for the buck, which would be, you know, how much greenhouse gases does a given measure reduce? Does it also reduce other air pollutants and benefit care communities? Is it innovative and replicable? So that's some things that we're considering in that bin. And then we're also thinking about, well, how easy or difficult might this implementation action be to move forward with? Is there a cost to implementation? Do we have the internal expertise within the agency and the available external partners to begin moving right away? So what's the readiness of implementation for that action? And obviously, on this scientific diagram here, we want to look toward the top right-hand box. You know, where do we get a good results and also something that we can move on quickly? So this allows us to follow a two-tiered implementation strategy. Ultimately, this is a long-range, very comprehensive plan, and we have to be smart and thorough about our strategic planning of how we're going to implement all these measures in a way that maximizes efficiency, but also gives us a coherency to how we're moving forward with implementation. But we can't stop, or we can't wait until we've completed that strategic planning process before we begin implementing. So what we're doing now is we are acting on some early priorities and taking action as we move forward with this comprehensive strategic planning process. And my next few slides are going to talk about what some of those early actions and implementation priorities are. So one key area of early implementation is rulemaking. And you've all seen a version of this table several times before. What we've done here is we've added this status column to the right so that you can see that staff has already taken quite a lot of action, and there is many of these rulemaking efforts are currently well underway. And besides rulemaking, another important role that the Air District plays in all of this is as a funder. So we've got a couple exciting new funding initiatives that will be kicking off in the next fiscal year, and we're taking initial steps to move forward with both of them already. We're looking at implementing a $4.5 million grant program, and this would help implement greenhouse gas reduction initiatives in communities, at the community level. And so right now, staff is looking at the control strategy and thinking how we can use these grants to help implement measures within that strategy. We're also planning to meet very soon with local government representatives, staff, other funding organizations, community organizations to get their input on our strategic funding strategy for this grant program. The Technology Implementation Office will help commercialize technologies that are already market ready but haven't been brought to scale yet. And we've already engaged in or begun the hiring process for the lead officer, and will soon be moving forward with the hiring process for the rest of the staff for this office. And as we get the office pulled together, including putting together a advisory group and beginning to research appropriate strategies, later in the year, we'll be hosting a regional technology forum. So we'll definitely be keeping this committee apprised on how work on both these efforts moves forward. And in addition to those new funding programs, we'll, of course, continue to sustain and expand the very successful programs that we've been implementing over the years. And you're familiar probably with most of these, but I just wanted to highlight a couple. We're in the midst right now of implementing our 2017 CHARGE program, which is very popular with public agencies and businesses. That is $5 million to fund electric vehicle charging stations. And we also very recently launched our 2017 Bicycle Facilities Grant Program, which is also a pot of $5 million, and that's to fund bike routes and bikeways and bike facilities throughout the region. So all of these established funding programs will continue to play a very important role as we implement the Clean Air Plan. Now, a lot of what we're talking about in the plan is a fundamental shifting, a societal shift away from fossil fuels and toward lower impact, cleaner forms of energy, and also reducing our overall demand for energy. And these are things, as Deputy Director Chang mentioned early in her presentation, a lot of this is going to take place at the local level. So working with local governments will be a cornerstone of implementing this plan. And as you all know, many local governments in the Bay Area are already very active in implementing innovative programs locally to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So what the Air District's role and what our value added is to this is to accelerate that local action so that we start achieving emission reductions at the speed and scale necessary to really achieve our long-term goals. So I'll just mention a couple of things that we've been doing recently. We convened a meeting of the heads of all the adopted community choice energy programs, and we're moving forward on some ideas for collaboration that came out of that meeting to support their efforts. We're continuing to work on a model solar ordinance project with the Bay Area Regional Collaborative and ABAG, BayREN staff. We've partnered also with MTC. So we're working with our regional agencies, I think, very well, and we'll continue to do that as we move forward. In addition to those early implementation priorities, we're also, as we go through this strategic planning process and look at all these several hundred implementation actions, we're seeing some cross-cutting, multi-sectoral themes emerging that indicate that we may have some multi-discipline, complex programs that we'll move forward with over the long term. And I just jotted down a few of them here. One, of course, will be working with our local governments. So a local government campaign will span most of these sectors. And we have to think very strategically about how we're going to engage with local governments in order to add value, but also be very efficient in what we're asking of local governments and how we partner with them. We're also seeing opportunities in certain source areas. So, for example, we've heard a lot of talk about trying to get organics out of the waste stream. But that reveals some interesting policy and technical issues as well. This may mean working with local governments to share best practices and policies, but there are a lot of technical issues too. Do we have enough composting facilities, and are they operating so as to minimize all emissions? So some of these cross-cutting initiatives require multiple partners, but also multiple disciplines within the Air District. And of course, I just mentioned partners. Key partners, of course, will be very important. They need to have a seat at the table as we move forward with implementation, because they will be key in implementing many of these measures and actions. And we've said many times that the Air District can't do this alone, and we recognize that part of our early effort has to be engaging these partners as we plan for the implementation of a lot of these programs. So moving forward, we will complete our strategic planning and prioritization process for all the control measures. We will be setting up a system that will allow us to track and report on the implementation, and we'll be reporting back to this committee on discrete actions and measures that we're implementing, as well as the overall results of implementing the plan. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. That wasn't long at all. So, any questions?
Thanks. I just want one thought, and a great, very succinct presentation, and great work happening. One thought on the support in the local government piece. Again, and this goes back to my comments to Ken around, you know, the resources or lack thereof that some of the smaller jurisdictions have, and or even smaller counties. And we're a slow growth county. We're actually looking at a labor force that's either, you know, leveled off or shrinking. So. And we do have staff dedicated towards all sorts of sustainability and climate related stuff, but they've been funded at different times over the years in different ways. For instance, I recall that there was a PG&E funded position around energy efficiency, and maybe that's kind of global high level, but I do think that maybe if we're really wanting to partner up and be synced up, you almost want to have someone embedded in a positive sense within the local government who is your partner. And there may be a need for or a positive function in having Air District funds help support a partial staff position. So you've actually, I mean, it would take, you'd have to have the jurisdiction totally buying in, but you need the resource again. And that is a tool that's been used in other ways to actually get programs, help implement programs that are coming from the outside.
We did include something like that when we did climate grants back a number of years ago. Is it Christina Rourke? I think, yeah, her position. We did the seed funding for that position, so, and she's still there. So, yeah.
Okay. Before I just totally jump past public comment, is there any public comment on this item?
I do have Jed Holtzman.
Okay, can we hear from Jed? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barrett and directors. This time I am speaking for 350 Bay Area again, Jed Holtzman. Just wanted to thank your staff. This continues to be extremely exciting for us. And as we talk to, like, I do a lot of work at the San Francisco level, a little more work at the regional level. Just since April 18th, I have run into so many high-level staff at departments or appointed or elected officials whose work dovetails with this in some way, but they don't know it yet. And I tell them what the Air District has done, and they're very excited and say, can you send me the plan? So I think my number one thing is, well, yeah, I'll send them volume one. But I think the number one thing for supporting local governments that I would say that you could do today is make sure that all of them are fully aware, and not just one point of contact in each county, but think of every department in every city and county that could possibly, you know, whose work, because a lot of them don't know very much about what's going on at the Air District, which I don't think is any fault of your own. There's just a tremendous amount going on at their own level. But this could, you know, this is, my point is made. The rulemaking calendar, I want to just make this point again. For this plan to be implemented, there's going to need to be a tremendous increase in rulemaking, as they have planned in the document, and as you've seen on this slide. And as the board of this agency, that is not going to really be possible without an increase in commitment from the board, both to wade through tremendous amounts of material that will come your way, but even to, you know, such trivial things as the amount of time that you allocate to these meetings into San Francisco from your jurisdictions. A lot of this stuff, you know, over the last few years has dragged on till people have had to leave. And what we're looking at is dozens more rules getting approved over the next couple of years than we've seen over the last few years. So just wanted to highlight that from both the agency staff here, but also from your own personal staff, and your own time, that this, you know, getting this done will require kind of a stepwise increase in effort. The last point, I just can't, and I apologize to Henry and Abby, I have to do this. Just anytime I see bioenergy, I have to just say 350 Bay Area does not support the use of bioenergy except where it is already created by our own activities like landfills, water treatment plants, and where it can be utilized on site to offset other energy use. That's great. We support that. We want to maximize that. But we don't want to incentivize the creation of fossil-based bioenergy where we could use electrification. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. No one else from the public? Okay. Well, I'll actually just jump on that because it the last point that you made, Abby, was about getting organics out of the landfill. And, you know, the county of Sonoma, practically every jurisdiction there is in negotiation right now with the garbage haulers. And, you know, Petaluma has been sort of in the vanguard of this issue in Sonoma County in that we have had total bio removal from the landfill so that, you know, restaurants, you can put your chicken bones, your fat, everything into the green waste. But that, you know, while we're doing that, there's been a problem with the actual getting that done at the hauler's end. And it is because of the problems that you just outlined about the infrastructure not being there. So I think that this is, you know, a good time for interaction with those people on the ground, those local communities. But it's also really important, as Jed just mentioned, where we build those contacts and we know what the Air District is hoping for and what our goals for, what are we working toward, and have that information given to the local agencies. You know, information exchange is just as important, or certainly as a first step, and the financial end of it is also important too. But we really need a lot of interaction, and not just with us, but with the staff as well. So, yes.
Just to follow up on that, I was in Sacramento yesterday at the trash bash, and they found out I was a member of this board, and a number of them came up to me and go, "Tell us how to make this work because it's so confusing." And they say if we go to the water, they give us a printout that shows what to do, but they come to the air board and they're talking about how to do the composting and we're not able to give them that information, and it makes it so it's very hard to go through that process.
Yes.
No, Director Wagon, connect all. There's a long standing relationship we have with the composters here in the district, and it is, as Abby indicated, it's a little of a very complex set of issues. Probably the most frustrating part of all of this is something we want to be able to be supportive of the direction to separate out organics. That's clearly where we need to go. The more and more we've done this, though, the problem, as you know, we've run across the odor issues. And I think that's largely to explain why we can't necessarily say here's a cookie cutter kind of approach here, because we have found that just simple type of steps being taken have exacerbated some odor issues considerably in some neighborhoods. And so we're trying to grapple with that issue at the same time, trying to also continue to encourage them to separate out and remove the organics. And so more to come, but it is ongoing. That's why you don't see me say, yep, we've got that. It's page 15.
We have jurisdictional issues. We have control technology issues. I mean, we understand what the control technologies are. They're pretty simple, but applying them on the scale that we're talking about now is significantly different for us. And you've heard Wayne, our Director of Enforcement, come and speak to the board about these issues. So yeah, it's an area that we continue to work on, and I think you'll be seeing more from us in this, especially as we bring forward some regulation over the next few years.
Yeah, and just one aspect also is they just don't seem to be following the practices that are necessary to minimize the odors. That is something that we continue to suffer from. And it explains a lot of the issues we have down in Milpitas, but it also is up in the northern part of the Bay Area as mm-hmm. well, and in Richmond. We've seen odor issues from Richmond drift across the bay and contribute to other issues because it mixed with the refinery odors as well. So it's a frustrating situation for us, but one in which we are very committed to tackle and separate and address.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. If I can be of any help, let me know. I sit on the county's Recycling Waste Reduction Commission. I would also say the person that works with us at Recology seems to really have an intimate understanding of what's really going on at some of these facilities. So his name is John Zarelli. And with him, I've toured our recycling plant, and I've toured our compost facility, which is open air in Milpitas. We've talked extensively about what's wrong with the anaerobic digesting system in San Jose, which, yes, it doesn't work because you take the stuff out, and in theory, it's all done digesting, and of course, it's not, and which is why it smells. One of the things the advisory council of this body talked about was doing an above air, so by plane or helicopter or something, survey of what's really, you know, where the methane's really coming from. And I don't know if we've thought about doing that, but, you know, we now, I guess, believe that there's maybe 3-4 times the methane that we had believed previously. So said the experts. And I'm wondering if maybe, you know, an aerial survey of the Bay Area to determine our hot spots would be in order. I think we all try to do these GHG things by city, but it's pretty hard to know on methane, right? In particular, how much is coming from that compost? And if we chose to enclose it, you know, what would that look like? Is there a cost? Maybe this is something the technology office can work with these agencies on, the, you know, the experts of the world, the ecologies and the folks that are actually running these things. And lastly, in my city, we are now requiring that organics be collected from restaurants and other such facilities. So that's now mandated. And but yes, today we're hauling it away, and it decomposes in the atmosphere, and then that, I mean, it's covered, right? But there certainly must be a lot of methane escaping, and then that makes terrific fertilizer once it goes through that process. But
That's a great comment on the aerial surveys. And we did last year contract with UC Davis and a professor there to conduct some aerial surveys of different sources of methane in the Bay Area. So looking at landfills, wastewater treatment plants, refineries, you know, some different types of sources, and doing a comparison to see if the way that we calculate emissions in our inventory kind of meshes with what we're actually reading in the atmosphere. So that's been kind of an early step in trying to better understand the actual methane emissions. And we're talking with some other folks about possibly pursuing more aerial surveys as well. So it is a really interesting part of our research.
And do we have any inkling of where the most of this is happening? Is it from our pipeline distribution system that PG&E largely operates, or cities operate, municipal utilities operate, or is it from composting facilities, or what?
It's still the biggest contributor is still the landfills.
Not composting per se.
And part of that is just because of the size of each. But we're learning, you know, more and more, and that's helping us refine what we're understanding about each of these sources.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Time and place away. Committee member comments? Seeing none. Time and place of next meeting, July 20th. Same here. And I guess we're adjourned. Okay, thank you very much.